Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast, set up with a grant from the Scarman Trust in 2002 and used to go out at noon every Tuesday on BCFM, Bristol's community radio station, 93.2. Dialect's produced by volunteers. If you want to join in, contact Volunteering Bristol, who are just off Queen's Square. You can call them on 0117 989 7733 or visit them on the web at bristolvolunteers.org.uk. And I'll repeat those contact details at the end of the show. This week, Sam Downey. We talk about Stokes Croft psychogeography. Also, Morris Kirk's here, the flying vet, is back. But we start this week with Sam Downey. Hi, Sam. Welcome to Dialect.
Thank you, Tony.
Tell us a bit about yourself. You're a freelance journalist, aren't you? And you've done a bit of work at the BBC.
I've been working with BBC World Service Radio, producing features for a show called Click, which is their weekly technology programme. And I'm also writing pieces and features on different news subjects for The Guardian in the commenters free section. And I'm also starting to write some news pieces for some local newspapers.
Now, the World Service, we are not worthy of the World Service because this is really goes out to millions of people right across the world. What have you been doing specifically with them?
Well, what I've been doing is programs with them, so it's mostly technology focused.
Well, do you want to just tell us which this new technology is? We want to get up to date.
I certainly do. I've been talking about local features, stories about science and healthcare within Bristol and South West. And I did a recent feature on a new robot that's been installed at Southmead Hospital called the Da Vinci robot.
Now, look, just tell us briefly about that, because I know I've heard all sorts of horror stories about it too. Lots and lots of great ideas, but it's not always as good as people would like it to be.
No, exactly. I've seen it up close and personal because they've done some demonstrations with a robot in their atrium for a public display, and it looks kind of really good. It can peel a grape, for example. but what that has to do with the human body, no idea. however, there's quite a few. It kind of looks good, does its job. With the stories that I don't know kind of much about the scare stories about it.
But so does this thing, does it, because I mean, I know they've been using robots up there for portering, for moving stuff around, there's been a few hiccups with that. So is this other robot, are they starting to use robots for surgery?
They have been. This one certainly does for surgery. This does prostate, does cancer on the prostate, for example, using lasers.
It's a kind of autopilot. You just press the button and it defines the cancer and does the surgery.
Well, yeah, almost. It does it very precision techniques, but of course there's humans around it at the same time as well, making sure nothing goes wrong. On that same story with the porter robots going around the hospital, there have been stories about loads of those robots getting stuck in corridors and not delivering, as it were.
Yeah, so you can put your laundry or whatever onto the porter and it sort of gets lost somewhere in between where it's supposed to be and where it's going.
Yeah.
I don't know if this is true. I've heard that these robots have sometimes kind of missed the door and then they go into the corner and they get stuck and start complaining with these sort of error messages. Anyway, I'm sure.
There's fun things like that.
But the thing is, look, there's a basic thing here, Sam.
Yeah.
If the porter robots are going wrong, I mean, is it really safe to allow a robot to perform surgery on a human?
With the help of a human and several humans in the same room.
Right, keeping an eye on it.
Yeah, then I think so. The answer is at the moment is yes, because it has no artificial intelligence. The robot has been programmed to do a certain function, and that's it. But it has no connection online. It does all kind of these very simple jobs. But it is very, very precise.
But look, my smartphone is programmed to do a certain function. It doesn't always do what it's told.
No, exactly. But that's because you keep on, you might update it over the air and it'll get updates quite a few, several times when features are added or security issues, for example, like that. Whereas this robot doesn't get those features.
Well, I'm glad you've got confidence in these computers, because I don't. But anyway, really, we could talk a little bit about Happy City, couldn't we? Because I know this is one of your areas of expertise. We've got this peculiar situation where the Happy City charity is trying to cheer everybody up when we've got mass austerity. And a lot of people are finding it actually impossible to continue paying the rent. They're having to go to their credit cards if they've got one. Impossible to pay the bills, electricity, gas bills, mm-hmm. things like that. We're coming into the winter now. And also having to go to food banks. And so this Happy City charity has turned up just at the right time to cheer everybody up. But why do you think there's a problem with it?
Well, I think the problem here now is from what I've talked to you in the past on several other Radio Dalek shows about them. I've talked in great deal about them. But there's a problem now as they concentrate on getting people feeling happy, but not concentrating on what the risks are. And this is balanced with a certain bit of belief, which is not religious belief, but it's believe it and it's true. So it's kind of like, you know, magic, for example. It's a magic trick because it uses a lot of distraction techniques.
So what's the danger in being happy? There can't be one, surely.
Naturally being happy. Yeah, okay, that's fine. That's smiling. I'm smiling now. You can tell that in my voice. but when it's coercion, when you're told to be happy, and you have to follow certain rules, then that's a different type of happiness. That's not a natural thing to do, and you know that you're being controlled.
So you're saying that the Happy Cities charity are starting to say to people, well, in order to be happy, you have to do this and this and this.
Yes. So an example is the 5 ways of well-being. This wasn't set up by them, but it's something which they do. So the 5 ways of well-being was set up by an organisation called the New Economics Foundation, NEF. And they are based in London. They're supported and by the UK government, the current government in power. And they started to set up this 5 ways of well-being as an index to measure people's well-being and also happiness. And they set up this measurement, and it's 5 ways of different ways to be happy. And of course, you've got to follow these rules in order to be happy.
Okay, so tell me, if I was one of those people who came along to you saying, I'm not very happy, I can't pay my bills, I'm having to go to food banks, and I can't get a job, what do I have to do in order to be happy?
Okay, right. Pause me there. Let me look up. I'll tell you. So the 5 ways of well-being, Tony, are these. It's to connect with people, be active, take notice, keep learning, and to give to people.
Hang on a minute. Giving is all very well, but what if you... I mean, what sort of giving is that supposed to be? Giving of the food in your cupboard that you don't have?
Maybe. Basically, I give a bit of background. So this organisation, New Economics Foundation, was commissioned by the government's Foresight Project on Mental Capital and Wellbeing to develop a set of evidence-based actions. Evidence-based means actually there's nothing there. You had to prove there's evidence to be there, basically, that there's something that you can do with that. So it's evidence-based actions to improve the personal well-being of people and citizens in the UK. In its reports, the New Economics Foundation presents the evidence and rationale between each of the actions of those 5 actions, drawing on a wealth of psychological and economic literature. So they did this research in 2008 as a project of the government, of the Foresight Project. And when I looked at the Foresight Project, they basically say, and there's a document on the government's website that says, please refer to the NEF. And the NEF says, please refer to the Foresight Project. So there's something gone amiss there with their bit of marketing. However, on the Foresight's documents on the government's website, there's a sentence on it that says, we need to find a way, this is written in 2008, that they need to find a way to do some, how to find ways to market these five ways of wellbeing to people.
Well, I mean, isn't that ostensibly good, you know, to actually get people to see which ways they are, what things will cheer them up?
Well, yeah, exactly. But when you're concentrating on this one word of wellbeing, there's another meaning of it. If you look it up in the dictionary, the other meaning of it is welfare of the person. And as we know, in the UK at the moment, the welfare is being cut from people. So therefore, you can say the wellbeing is also being cut.
Don't you think there's a bit of an implication here that if you're upset or you're not happy, that it's your own fault? And that actually isn't always the case, is it?
No, it's not. But this is the implication also of these five ways of wellbeing.
It almost sounds like a kind of psychological bullying.
Yes, it is. I've known people who have been bullied by this process.
Okay, so in what way? How has it affected them?
They, when they spoke to me about it, they said it actually offered to them nothing. They did these happiness courses, some well-being courses, over a period of 8 weeks, they were 2-hour sessions. But they didn't realise that this 8 weeks were a type of CBT, cognitive behavioural therapy sessions. And each session, what they taught, they were teaching themselves not to be negative, and only focus on the positives. So that forces you to do exactly that. But because you force yourself to only focus on the positive things that are going on, you're not actually thinking and using your critical thinking skills.
That means you're blocking out quite a lot of things that you should be dealing with and, you know, sort of processing through. In a way, it's a form of enforcing a denial on you.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is actually a kind of mental illness in itself. It sounds pretty horrible. Anyway, yeah. I know that the Happy City was based here in Stokes Croft, wasn't it?
They were.
We're talking from the Stokes Croft studios in People's Republic of Stokes Croft and just around the corner. So yeah, are they still there?
The address was 77 Stokes Croft. And a reason why I can say that is because there's a huge 77 number on their building. If you drive up the A38 through Stokes Croft, you'll see it on your left-hand side and it's opposite the canteen. So it sticks out like a sore thumb. But they actually set up this building, and they've owned it for the last 3 years. And now, strangely, below them there was a central heating organisation, and that company moved out and then went bust, and the space below them became derelict. And Happy City were going to be taking that space over and do a cafe and put workshops and spaces underneath that.
To make everyone even more happy.
Yeah, make it a really good community space. But of course, no, that's been left derelict. And then they, what I found out was they had moved out of the building, and they are now based at the headquarters of Age UK in Bristol. And I recently talked to Age UK very, very briefly just to find out if they knew anything about who Happy City were. They denied it at the time, but they are doing a couple of projects with Happy City.
So where is this Age UK? Whereabouts are they?
And they are on Victoria Street.
Right.
And that's near Temple Meads.
Yeah, it's in between Bristol Bridge and Temple Meads.
Yes.
So, I mean, this is great. I love all this stuff where we're talking about, you know, various sort of organisations. Mm-hmm. Particularly when they're kind of quasi-governmental, you know, quite a lot of government funding.
Yeah, exactly.
And where they are in the city, particularly around here in Stokes Croft, you mentioned briefly, didn't you, there, the canteen. Mm-hmm. Now that, I don't know, is it still? It was certainly at one time owned by George Ferguson.
It still is. Yes.
Because a lot of people don't realise that. In a way, I mean, I look at that and I think, well, hey, this is really low down with the kids, man. It's almost like a kind of, you know, alternative cafe. But mm-hmm. actually, well, it's a, obviously it's a bar. So, you know, it's yeah. quite a important event space. But George Ferguson, the mayor, owning this kind of alternative venue, in a way, it's a kind of, isn't it a way of him sort of almost marketing himself and selling his vision to the city?
Yeah, it's one of his spaces, but also people don't need to forget that he also owns he's a part shareholder in Coexist, which is the organisation who are also in the same building. When you start looking up, you can use Companies House, and
which I know you do quite a lot,
and also use Endel, which is another website which uses the same data from Companies House. With all that, you can find out who the directors are of companies, and mm-hmm. and also see how much each of the buildings cost themselves as well. And so those two tools, online tools, which are free for anyone to use and look at, you can actually start putting some research together. And there's plenty of things you'll find about George Ferguson and a lot of his venues around Bristol. And they're growing by the minute.
Really?
And it's not just with him. It's also with Susrans as well.
Okay, so let's look. I mean, you know, it's interesting to hear that George has got this kind of encampment halfway up Stokes Croft. I think it was the that building. What do you know? What the actual building's called originally? Or it's a something house.
Yes. Originally, that building was owned by a insurance company.
Yes. Well, I'll tell you what. Before that, it was owned, because I had a look into this a few years ago. Mm-hmm. It was owned by the Church of Christian Science.
Oh.
That particular piece of land, and then they sold the land, and that's when they built the office block on there. So this has had an interesting past, this building. I mean, we've also got a bit further up. The Carriage Works, which is like a running sore in Bristol for decades, which is now apparently going to be redeveloped. If the, I mean, the thing is, we're in a weird situation housing-wise nationally, where house building has stalled because a lot of house builders, private house builders, mm-hmm. like the people who intend to build there, are finding that they've built flats, they've built houses, but they're not selling.
Yeah, there's I can give you a good example. There's a the old Bristol North Baths, which have also been developed into flats.
That's way up the A38, isn't it?
That's Orfield. In Bishopston, And they are now, there's a new story that came out a few days ago with Chatsworth House, which are the developers of the site.
Well, alleged developers, yes.
They are going to be pulling out by the end of this year, so end of December 2015.
They're handing over the baton to another outfit, a bunch of cowboys. No, what's happening?
Well, those cowboys are, of course, Bristol City Council. They're handing it back to them. They will take over. They will try and complete it. But what that means is there's also Bristol Bishopston Medical Practice, which is where my GP is. They are also going to be moving themselves into that building as well. So a nice new medical practice in there, and also a pharmacy
in Bristol North Baths?
In Bristol North Baths.
How long until this actually happens? I keep hearing promises about this. Was a beautiful bath. I actually went there once or twice when it was open as a swimming bath.
Yeah, me too.
Fantastic place. Mm. I actually went in as well when it was occupied by a group protest saying, well, why are you closing our baths down? And it was in fantastic condition, a beautiful, I think, I don't know if it's Victorian.
It is Victorian,
It's absolutely
Some of it has been kept, but they have made a mess of it. So the story now goes, Bishopston Medical Practice, they've pulled out this month. And also the pharmacy have also moved out of the building. They don't want to be part of it any longer. And so they're now looking for other premises. And there's a video on the BBC's local news pages with a interviewer journalist who went in there called Dickon Hooper, and he did a good piece of interviewing the developers and saying what's going to be happening to the space. And they said that the building is not going to be a library any longer. So that was also part of the plan by Bristol City Council. That's gone as well. So no local library for Bishopston. And the flats are almost, the only plan is the flats are going to be completed somehow. But they've only got 2 months to do that now. And
the rest of it's not going to happen, is it? You think so?
I don't know. We shall see. But yeah, when they pull out at the end of this year, and we see if Bristol City, what is Bristol City's City Council's next move is going to be on it. I don't know.
Well, it's fascinating. I love these little psycho-geographical tours around there. Usually it's to do with up and down Gloucester Road in a way, but elsewhere. Yeah. I mean, the other pool I think that's worth mentioning is Speedwell Pool, which is really, I mean, for anyone that drives up that way, it's been in mothballs for, God, must be 10 years now. These wonderful facilities, which were built, some of them even just before the war in the 30s as part of the attempts and successful attempts really to get Britain out of the Great Depression in the 1930s, as well as of course a lot of council houses were built in those days too, and these facilities, for them to be just mothballed, I think is appalling, you know, with no actual plans for them. We're just closing them down. And I mean, if you look at the way that private operators are able to operate pools, at the very least they could do is to hand them to a private operator to get on with it.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe they could just give us a call. We could manage to turn a profit, I think, from that for over a year. But anyhow,
yes, there's some good office spaces in there.
Yeah, it's not just offices. I mean, you could also use them as you know, return them back to space. Operating them as a pool.
Yeah, exactly.
But anyhow, well, Sam, is there anywhere else you'd like to point to up and down Stokes Croft before we say goodbye? That you know has got a, as you walk past, you can give everyone a little bit of an insight to what's going on behind those walls.
Okay, so yeah, let's move position very slightly, and we can go to St Paul's. And we can talk, I'll talk very briefly at the moment about St Paul's Carnival.
And the St Paul's Learning Centre, possibly, is that where these decisions are being made?
No. The decisions are going to be made coming up this week at Malcolm X. Meeting on Friday,
yeah,
between 4 and 6 as a public meeting. However, City Council won't be there. And nor will most of the members of the St Paul's Carnival group either, because most of them have sided with the City Council. They've moved to the City Council. So there's kind of two stories here. You've got the City Council who say, we will take the festival and run it ourselves, and we will take some of your team with us, and we'll run something and put it on in maybe 2 years' time. As I said, there won't be one next year. However, yeah, you've now got a public meeting taking place, and there's a huge dialogue going on Facebook at the moment, where an outrage, where there's local musicians talking about that they want to do something that's organised locally, and they don't want the council being part of it. And they say there's a funding story.
I mean, is it that the council don't trust people of St Paul's to get on and do a carnival?
I don't think so. I think it's some sort of funding.
Basically, well, I mean, that's the council, surely. If the council won't hand over the money, how can the St Paul's people who are paying their council tax, I presume, how can they have a carnival?
They want to have overall control over what's going on. So we had these Make Sunday special events, which have been taken place not just throughout the centre now, it's been in various other places. It's been expanded to St George, to Easton, and there wasn't one in St Paul's this year. They wanted one to take place, but they had several bits of opposition to it. So maybe next year they'll have a Make Sunday special event there. That's probably one thing which Ferguson wants to do if he's still in power.
It seems like quite a lot of central control. Of course, yeah, there's an election, isn't there, May next year. Anywhere else you'd like to point to around the city? You were saying that George Ferguson, his little encampments that he owns around the city are expanding hourly. No, you didn't say that, sorry. But anywhere else you'd like to point to apart from the tobacco factory, which everybody knows about pretty much,
yes,
in Bedminster, Southville. And then, of course, the canteen on Stokes Croft, mm-hmm, on the right-hand side as you, yep, go up north, yep, just out of the city centre.
Okay, so another building is Brunel House. So this was a building designed by Isambard Kingdom Brunel as a hotel, in 1835, I think, or 1840. And this is now currently owned by Bristol City Council, but they're selling it for, I think it's about £2.5 million, maybe a bit more than that. and it's on the market right now, so anyone can go and buy it if they're interested. And basically, it's quite interesting because this building is sitting behind the council hall, the city hall, and there's some sort of George Ferguson and his friends, I say, are all partners and members in the management of this building. So they are the owners, and they'll take some profit off whoever buys this
building.
Okay,
so the Brunel House, is that where Triodos Bank is? That's the building immediately behind.
Yeah, it's nearby. It's just Triodos House is
So far as you know, only buildings that George owns and controls are Tobacco Factory and here the canteen.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
But there's one more story. Of course there is. His architect company, Fergus Mann, are the architects. They are next door to the Bristol Library. There's a building that's been has been developed over a number of years. And it's next door to the library, next door to the school there. And the building is almost complete. And I looked at some of the plans for this building a couple of months ago, and I noticed something. The part of these plans is to have a school somewhere of this building. So, of course, where is this school going to be built? Well, we know the story is it's going to be in the library building. That's why they've started to close down the lower parts of the library and the lower floors. And they're also thinking about closing down the other parts of the library as well.
So this maybe is the central library, the city centre. Yeah, yep. Closing down parts of that. So in what way is George's firm, Ferguson Mann, involved in that then?
Well, they're the architects behind it.
Who are they? Crikey.
And so, yeah.
He's a great architect. Maybe we should call him Lord Ferguson.
He's not a Lord Sugar, I don't think.
Anyway, Sam Downey, thanks ever so much for joining us on Dialect again. Hope to have you back soon.
Thank you for having me, Tony.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Well, I'm joined again now by Maurice Kirk, the flying vet. Maurice, you're not flying today, are you?
No, I'm not.
Do you want to just remind us about this whole flying vet business? Because am I right in thinking that you had a veterinary surgery and you got banned from driving, so you decided you were going to fly into the farms instead?
That was in Somerset. I mean, here I am in Bristol, and it's lovely to be back, where I was a veterinary student for more years than the average veterinary student.
Was that because you were finding the course a bit difficult?
Well, I was doing what we call extramurals, whatever, rock climbing at night with gas lamps on acetylene lamps on our heads, and caving through the night.
Okay, whereabouts were you doing that then? Not up on the Avon Gorge, surely?
Yes. Oh yes, we used to use our caving lamps, which were acetylene in those days. This would be 1963-64. And when we got to the top, we always made sure we got to the top of the rock face before closing time so we could get to the coronation tap.
But isn't that a bit dangerous, especially if you've got an acetylene torch on your head and you're relying on a rope as well? Isn't it possible that the acetylene torch might interfere with the rope? In fact,
No. I was an instructor in North Wales, and of course, before I came to university, as a very young kid, and of course, the story I remember was I was in New Zealand in Auckland, having just flown my aircraft, my wartime aeroplane around New Zealand, and I rang up this old man, and I used to be a climbing instructor in North Wales, and I looked up the Pennygrid Hotel, and I looked up on the ceiling, and I counted, I think it was 25 rock climber, climbing mountaineers signatures, and yours was one of them. He said, "Where are you? Where are you?" I said, "I'm 100 yards from your house, Sir Edmund Hillary." He said, "Come on down, come on down. Come and have some cake and tea. There's a whole queue of people with film cameras and everything else, but come and talk to me about North Wales." Sorry, I digress.
And you did?
I did. Oh, yes. What a man. You meet very few people in your life. You'll never forget such a gentleman. When I left, I knew immediately who was the first on the top of Everest.
Well, he's bound to say that, isn't he?
No.
I thought Sherpa Tenzing was the one that really got to the top of Everest.
I didn't say that. Once I left his house, I realised who got there first.
When you say he was a gentleman, how did he treat you?
Well, I can't put into words. You don't meet people like that in your life. What, once, twice in your life? And it was an absolute pleasure. And I tried to raise the money to get to his funeral. And I was very upset that we had no royalty there.
So he wasn't big-headed. He was quite modest, but intelligent, well-read.
Well-read, extremely modest, which means we clashed a bit. But what a gentleman. I've got a photograph on my website with me shaking him by the hand. I said, could I just take a photograph, please? And he said, and I quickly put on my old bow tie. And about 4 years later, I noticed that the bow tie wasn't even under the collar. I'd put it on so quick. Oh, I was in cloud nine, you know, walking on clouds.
That was a different kind of era, wasn't it, really? Where there were, I mean, people would say now that all those sort of physical challenges, different parts of the world, they've been done. So
yes, but
where do we go from here?
He had hemp ropes. He had trichones, which are metal sort of triangular things on the edge of your leather shoes, boots. And none of this special thermal gear. It was all very 1920s stuff. Amazing, man.
But, I mean, you know, this was an era, wasn't it, for a British Empire, I suppose, and we were sold, I think most of us at school, this great vision of the great British Empire. Actually, the truth was pretty horrible behind that. There was a fantastic amount of genocide went on, wasn't there? I mean, you know, you wouldn't deny that, would you?
Yes, I thought you might touch on the more political aspects.
Well, it is,
this.
You know, it was we were sold it as kids, certainly. This there was some great thing called the British Empire. I think nowadays, I think that would be laughed out of court because, you know, these lands were stolen.
No. The integrity that we introduced into those foreign countries. I mean, I'm about to fly.
What about concentration camps in Kenya? That's not integrity.
Well, I was the veterinary surgeon on Alderney, and it was the only island in the British Isles that had a concentration camp. Not many people know that. It happened to be a German concentration camp. But I'm on the way to Kenya, and I'd like you to ask me after I've been there so I can talk to them, because I'm flying my old wartime aeroplane to Cape Town.
Tell us a bit about your aircraft. You've got several, haven't you? Piper Cubs in various states of repair or disrepair.
Well, very short of money now. It's something about affairs of the heart that have caused me to lose any hard-earned income.
But is it nothing to do with your court case at South Wales Police? Is that...
That's taken the odd bob or two.
What's that? Okay, because it's a while since we spoke to you about that. So what's the latest?
Well, it's a 23-year running court case. It's the biggest South Wales Police battle that they've ever had to face.
And the latest instalment was when they started stopping you time after time, day after day, asking for your insurance papers, a form of harassment, which is a pretty cheap thing for the police to play on somebody.
Well, an aspect of my damages claim is 23 years of harassment as a practicing veterinary surgeon in the Vale of Glamorgan. I mean, 3 a.m. going to a calving or a womb out or a road traffic accident, and I'd get stopped and demanded to see all my documents. Now, on the 34 times they demanded to see my documents, they'd seen them the week before. So on the 35th occasion, I used an expression which I can't repeat here, which is quite plausible and acceptable, but we won't. And I went to court for failing to produce my insurance. And I went to court and said, no, they looked at my insurance 34 times. And why should I produce it yet again? And I won that under Section 10 or 11 of the Magistrates Act on the basis of probability. But since then, this is important. I've been stopped 7, possibly 8 times to produce my documents, and I have refused outright, and nothing has been done about it. That is what's important. That's outrageous.
Well, this isn't going to be happening too much in the future, isn't it? I mean, I noticed this week in the Independent, I think on the front page of the I paper, they're saying there's going to be no more money for Bobbies on the Beat anymore. I mean, I know these are traffic police, but there's not enough resources around. There's not enough money to allow police to go cruising around keeping an eye on people.
No, don't take your eye off the ball about the South Wales Police. What is serious about this is that seven times since, when they realised who I was, they did not pursue the fact that I refused to produce my driving documents, my insurance, my driving licence, and what's the other one? MOT. And nothing was done about it. Now, that is an indictment in itself.
Might it also be a lack of resources within the police these days?
No. They burnt the midnight oil with me for 20 years and had my name removed from the veterinary register by going to court to say that my attitude on the roadside was not compatible with a professional person dealing with a local police force. The South Wales Police Force is something else. I will not dare anybody compare it with the Avon and Constabulary or the Metropolitan, where I've had wonderful time with them. I was arrested, jailed three times in about 3 weeks, and each time they apologised and they gave me coffee and tea and
compensation?
Oh, no. They were so specially human about it. It was a pleasure after leaving Wales.
I mean, I don't think of you as a jailbird so much as an aviator, really. So just dragging you back to your Piper Cubs, how many and what state of repair are they in? Because I know you're intending to do this trip to Cape Town, aren't you, next year?
Yes. Well, next November, there is going to be an accumulation of very old birds, biplanes, pre-war aeroplanes from Germany, all over Europe. And we're getting together to fly from Crete to Cape Town. Just do the website and you'll find it. And I have two old World War II Piper Cubs. My third one is at the bottom of the Caribbean. I've told you all about that one.
Oh, right, yes.
After I landed too close to Mr. Bush's ranch. But these two, one is fit and flying. The other one is in pieces. And I'm looking for pilots. I'm also looking for passengers because we're going to be doing it in short legs with about 20 or 30 other aeroplanes. So we're looking for anyone who wishes to fly the Cub, help rebuild the second Cub here in Bristol or somewhere in Somerset. It's a 1943 Cub used on the D-Day landings, just like the one that I'm flying in at the moment.
Hang on. Used in the D-Day landings? What did it? What way was it involved?
They brought them in about a week after the initial invasion, in 4th of June, and they would fly them off a 200-foot wooden deck into wind, because they'd get airborne about 35, 38 miles an hour. So they'd steam along at 10 knots into a wind of, say, 10 knots. So they only wanted 200 feet of wooden box. And they'd be in boxes, and the Americans would put the wings on and fly them onto the beach, where they would refuel and join General Patton with his tank regiments to carry messages in between all the way up to Berlin. And they were designed to land in the snow and plough fields.
So hang on, was Patton communicating with Hitler?
Patton was a pilot. He actually flew the Cubs.
Right, but he shouldn't have been talking to Hitler. It was the Second World War.
No, he was on the way to...
I think he had actually been quite overly friendly with the Nazis, unfortunately. At the end of the war, he wanted to join with them, didn't he, and attack Moscow.
Well, he was a controversial gentleman. Yes, I would like to have met him, actually. He would have been my sort of chap.
You reckon?
I think so.
Would you like to join with Hitler and attack Moscow?
No. The argument on the politics in 1945, when I was born, there was serious argument and sensible balance in suggesting that we turn against the communists.
Well, that was only because the communists were going to take, or at least they had done in many parts of the world, take large monopolistic industries off people who were basically not bothering to do anything, monopolising markets, weren't they? I mean, that's one of the arguments for socialism, is that and you could argue for it today, that there are industries like electricity in Britain now, the things that have been nationalised, telecoms, etc., who are just bleeding the country dry.
Yes, the balance of power for those organisations that give us what you're on about, is the essential services. I am right wing, and I always will be, but I was very disappointed with my heroine Maggie in her last 2 years, where she went down that route.
Well, it wasn't just her last 2 years. She started off by privatising the buses, didn't she? There were a whole load of other things, the shipbuilding, airports, you know, everything else. She was a privatiser in chief.
No, I'll take you on if you want. It'll take till breakfast time.
Well, just a minute. One thing, the airports, the British Airports Authority was basically a quango that ran the airports across the country, the major airports. That was just sold off, wasn't it? I mean, it's something you know quite a bit about, being an aviator.
Are you suggesting that was a mistake?
Yeah. Yes, I am. I mean, because as soon as you're a private individual controlling something like Heathrow Airport, then all of a sudden you can just start racking up prices. Any kind of monopolistic, it's not as if people in London are going to go, oh, maybe we could get a train to Cardiff and use Cardiff Airport instead. Yes. You've got the customers by the short and curlies.
Well, no, it's all based on market forces. If it's privately, they have to justify the cost, they have to pay, they have to answer to their bankers.
Well, there's very little regulation of these things. This is what's happened over the years. There's almost no regulation, for example, of the electricity industry. They can charge pretty much what they want.
Well, there's competition there. You're saying that the private companies have got together and done a ring.
Yeah, they do. Of course they do. It's an oligopoly, isn't it? It's not a monopoly. It's where an industry association gets together and say, well, we're going to fix the prices at this. And the government is really just powerless in that sort of situation, as are the consumers, us that have to pay the bills.
Yeah. One very small aspect of my life is that, A, I'm into private enterprise. But when it comes to public services, I've always believed, sadly I'm going to have to agree with you.
Oh, gosh.
That's terrible, isn't it?
That's right.
That some of the public services should have been controlled by government.
So what was it that persuaded you that aviation and this trip to Africa was going to be a good idea?
Well, I flew little old Cub to Australia, I remember, and I flew it around New Zealand, and then I flew it up through Japan, where I crashed in the centre of the city.
And good God. Which city in Japan?
Kanazawa, opposite side to Tokyo.
What, did you not put it down on a runway, road?
I was at the top of a mountain when the engine stopped. I was on the way down to Oklahoma. I like that
Okinawa.
To Hiroshima. I felt that I was so close to Hiroshima that any human being should have a duty to go there and stand and keep quiet and think. And I failed to do that because the engine stopped about 50 miles north of it, and 100 miles it might have been. And the glide of the mountain was equal to the glide of the slope of the mountain was equal to the glide of the wartime Cub. So
you were coming down at roughly the same rate as the mountains were.
The angle of descent was equal to the, and my wheels were just above the fir trees, and the silence, total silence, remember. I mean, people don't fly aeroplanes very often where there's silence.
Were the local birds of prey squawking?
Oh, I saw
watching
them.
Watching you?
And I saw them. But it was the smell. It was the smell of the trees. And there I was desperately trying to find 100 yards to land on. And in the end, I went for the river in the middle of the city and didn't quite make it. And I saw a park full of children. I turned towards it because it was into wind, and suddenly realised those little black dots were lots of little kids. And so I had to turn and run with the wind and land on a road where a little old lady came out onto the road in front of me, and I twitched 3 feet to the right, and 3 feet of my wing hit a parked lorry. The rest of that was a pas de deux or a pirouette or whatever you call it. I went down the road, the engine finishing up on my lap and me soaked in fuel, and I ran down the road 12 feet, hit the ground, damaged my head badly, finished up in hospital. Why? Because the rope to my dinghy, my life raft, was 12 feet long. And I ran, and I went straight on the floor.
Well, I'm glad
I could ramble on all
night.
Yeah,
you've had so many accidents in those aircraft. It's amazing that you still want to get back in and take to the air again. Anyway, Maurice Kirk, thanks very much for joining us again on Dialect.
Thank you very much. Lovely to be here.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
And I'm joined now by Rick Margetts, who lives here in Bristol. Hi, Rick.
How you doing, Tony?
Now, I know you've had done quite a bit of internet radio stuff in the past. What made you get into that? I know you were doing basically like building work and construction work, that sort of thing. How did you make that transition into doing internet radio? Was it just to keep you sane in the evenings after?
Well, that was it. It was a bizarre journey, really. I joined up with a group of people who wanted to set up a station in America, and we tried to get something rolling. We were doing a 24-hour radio marathon, but we were coming up with so many guests, and each guest wanted an hour. So we were running this radio station. It very, very soon became 48, and then it became
36, 72.
It stayed at about 36 hours.
So, what did you set up? Some sort of little studio at home, or what?
We set up a studio at home. It was we tried to do something that was rolling around the world. So we had a producer in the US. We had a producer here in the UK, which was me. And we had a producer over in Germany, which was a lovely chap called Detlev. And we used to send the radio station. So I would produce. I was probably the better one at it, so I would put in a lot of hours. But we would sign the radio station off. We would send the main hub that we were using. We would switch over, and then it would go over to America. And then
but hang on a minute, you're putting a lot of time into this. You've also got to be doing your construction work. You've also got to be doing. You've got a family as well to look after.
I do, yeah. Three kids as well, yeah.
So how do you find the time for it?
Organisation was the key. Really. I found with it. I had a calendar for construction work, and it was very structured. Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, you would see what I was doing on the evening, and then I had a separate one for the radio because. We started having loads of different radio stations as well. So I encouraged my station was called the International Community Radio Network, and it was and we would have lots of different shows. So we would have sort of Judith Hitchin would come on. She would do a show 2 days a week. So I would sort of log in, and I would produce her on the evening. And when you looked at my calendar, I was probably doing more radio stuff in the end than I was actually workload. I
mean, what about the kids? Where did they come in? Or didn't they?
Yeah, well, no, I used to do it in my kitchen. So we had an healthy relationship. They used to get frustrated with me if I was talking on the radio because it meant they had to shut up.
Okay, so tell us a bit about the construction stuff that you've done over the years.
Construction, I was I sort of grew up being a plumber, really. Moved into management, battled for a couple of years with construction safety, which was a minefield. And the more sort of,
well, it's important, isn't it? It's actually very important. A lot of people die on construction sites.
We do kill, yeah. Construction does kill a lot of people.
It's a bit like aviation or something. It's inherently dangerous, really.
I mean, I think the problem now, you get a lot of people come into health and safety with no construction background whatsoever, and that can be as dangerous. That can be as dangerous as anybody with no practical experience whatsoever. And there's a massive lack of people coming from the tools and getting into health and safety. And also the regulation. I mean, trying to stay on top of all the regulations, because the regulations change within health and safety so
but
quick.
But I mean, I've read this recent book, Blacklisted, by Phil Chamberlain. Is it Dave Roberts? I'm not sure. The other chap from Unison, I think, is one of the big trade unions. And Phil Chamberlain's up at the University of the West of England, one of the senior lecturers in journalism up there. And he's just brought out this book about blacklisting. The construction industry is absolutely rife with this. Some of them really big companies.
So they will look at people like you and they will
say, well, we don't want him around. Basically, anybody that's bringing up health and safety concerns can find themselves without a job for the rest of their life on these blacklists.
Well, you know, it's a problem within the industry, and it's not just health and safety that's been. It's also people from construction background who have sued companies that they've worked for, and you know, there's a lot of things.
There's
in
union
the mix.
Activists as well get blacklisted.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, even coming out and speaking sort of publicly. as we do, can make things very difficult for us in the construction industry.
And
as
also,
well.
But you did do a bit of work on the nuclear facility, what became a nuclear facility anyway, in Oxford. Just south of Oxford, is it Culham?
It was the particle collider that I was doing a little bit of work on. Yeah, I did the cables, but I was very
whereabouts,
late.
Exactly, whereabouts is that? Is it like in Oxford or outside? You know, where?
I'm not 100% sure. It's quite a few.
Hang
it was quite
on,
a
you
few
did
years.
The work on it.
It was quite
where
a few.
Where were you driving to?
Well, I wasn't the driver. My buddy Sam was driving at the time, so I never. I'm terrible in a car.
So you were doing cabling.
If I'm not. We were pulling the Cat5 cables in at the time, yeah.
Which is?
It's sort of data cables, data networks. We were running the data networks around the place. And there was a big problem with World War II bombs up
Ooh.
There. Yeah, it was...
Well, I wonder if it's the same place I'm thinking about, because I went into the Culham Laboratory, that's just south of Oxford, where there's what they call Joint European Torus, which is JET, TAURUS, which is a European fission project, and that was called what they call the donut, which is a massive coil of electrical wires around a giant donut shape, and they were putting a whole power of the entire national grid, basically phoning around the national grid, telling all the power stations to go up to full capacity, and then they were apparently around large parts of the country, if you were walking around at night, you would hear the pylons crackling because they were putting all of the generating power into that thing and trying to make it what they allegedly said was to generate power from it. Well, actually, of course, they didn't generate any power. The physicist I knew who was working there said actually when they first ran the experiment, as they call it, the experiment, they realised from the test results there was never ever going to be any kind of electricity generated out of it. But guess what? Because they built it, the military decided that they might be able to find a use for it, because the plasma they generated in the middle of this donut was the same temperature roughly as an atomic explosion. So they could simulate an atom bomb without having to have an atmospheric test and test out all sorts of different materials to put into that atom bomb without having to do an atmospheric test. So it didn't break the test ban treaty. So basically the whole thing was a massive European EU funded civilian project, but actually really if you scratch the surface you find it was military stuff going on in there.
Sounds like you know a lot more about it than
well, that was that. If it's the same place, I'm not sure. But anyhow, so it just runs through the community. What happened? Because it's not there anymore, the community radio, internet radio you were doing.
Unfortunately, due to personal circumstances, the amount of time I was spending on it, it probably nearly cost me my marriage. Well, it nearly did cost me my marriage.
Well, you probably made the right decision there.
I had
to
pull back a little bit.
Yeah.
And, of course, the other problem is content as well. So trying to control the content and not let every lunatic through the door and put them on the air becomes a real problem. And if you're trying to do something on a with different countries, the problem we were finding, different people were organising guests in different countries. And to try and vet all these guests, I mean, if you're talking 3 days of, well, it would turn out to 4 days a month specifically for the radio marathon that we were doing. We would have issues with trying to vet everybody within that. You know, that's 24 hours. That's 24 hours a day for 4 days. You know,
yeah.
That's,
so it's too much work, isn't it?
It's a lot of work to do.
What sort of nutters did you have on then?
Well, we had somebody. For an example, it wasn't just people with obscure beliefs. It was who they were being matched up with online. So you would have a political analyst over in the US, and they would put somebody who was investigating the NHS baby fetuses being sold off to Satanist baby munchers, you know, and they'd put them on at the same time together, and you know, it's a clash, you know.
Yeah, I can imagine that would be a bit difficult to manage. Well, yeah. In a way, it's good, because what you're doing is there's this, you know, even if it's been a bit of a disaster in some occasions, it is a very new kind of technology that certainly an arena that radio's moved into on the internet, because it's allowed a lot more freedom, getting guests from all over the world without that much regulation. I mean, it's almost bound to go wrong. But anyway, so what would you think were the big lessons that you learnt from it?
Really, the big lessons would be managing the guests managing the content and trying to get some structure in place beforehand. It's much easier to manage an internet radio station if you're proactively managing it rather than reactively managing it. If you're trying to react, you're reacting to every situation too late, and it's called fire brigade management.
That's what they called it at the BBC. Yeah. Oh, we've got fire brigade management here. I remember years ago pointing at a couple of the senior managers because basically they were not looking at the. I mean, they weren't learning from when as something's flagged up to a manager, they need to be able to assess if they're any good. This is something that really needs some action now to avoid more problems in the future.
Yeah, well, like anything, you know, it's how you adapt and it's how you build your foundations going forward as well. So as long as you take things sort of slow, take it steady, make sure the foundations are in place. I think, you know, there's big hope for internet radio in general.
Is there anything that you listen to you'd recommend at the moment or not?
I stay away from a lot of internet radio at the moment because I end up getting pulled in because I'm so good with the back end production. I'm forever picking holes in people's bits and pieces. So I say, you know, well, why didn't you try and do this?
Okay, well,
and before you know it, you're pulled into a 24 hour.
So, what about? Okay, I'm going to try and pin you down on this though. You recommend us a internet outfit of some sort? That's worth listening to, maybe, or even just a website, a news website, because, I mean, one of the things that everyone's pretty much agreed on is that the mainstream media in most of the Western world, other parts of the world too. I mean, you go to China, it's even worse, or
well,
just as bad.
I mean, there's loads of internet radio. I've always quite liked the Republican Broadcasting Network over in America.
So, what is that, Alex Jones?
No, I don't think Alex Jones is on. He's not on RBN, is he?
I don't know.
No. I try to stay. Alex is far too in your face, and
Well, not only that. I mean, isn't he a disinformation agent? I thought he was.
I'm pretty sure he is. I called him out on the UK column. I did an interview with the UK column just after we were at the Bilderberg protest, and the stick I got online. For suggesting that Alex Jones.
Good. Well, you're probably right. I think you're right. I mean, a lot of the stuff he's. I mean, many, many people in the States who have been quite loyal to his exposing the 9/11 attacks, which was obviously good stuff, are really annoyed about the way he's going now, particularly. But I mean, it's interesting, isn't it? How actually, what happened in the 1990s is William Cooper, who was a genuine radio host in the States, former naval intelligence officer, built up a big following on FM radio and on shortwave in the US, in Arizona, I think he was living in Eagle, Arizona, and broadcasting. He began with a little FM transmitter in Eagle, Arizona, and he had so many people trying to listen to him that he had to go onto the internet and onto shortwave as well. People phoning him from Canada, etc., all over the place, and a massive following. So Alex Jones pops up next door in Texas, and starts doing a similar sort of thing, and there was an immediate clash.
They hated each other. Bill Cooper called him out because
he was saying basically that Jones was lying about
Well,
him.
Also, it's interesting
because I just picked up on one broadcast that Alex Jones did where this is in the mid-1990s sometimes when Vladimir Putin first appeared on the scene, where Jones is saying, oh, well, this guy, he resembles a demon. And you think, well, okay, isn't this classic demonization of the Russians? Is this a sort of Cold War psychological warfare operation? What's going on with Jones? So, you know, it's interesting, I think, that you've got your job, in a way, as running your community radio international one, is to try and discern. Because the last thing you want to be doing is to be putting out disinformation.
It's very difficult, yeah. And even a half-truth is still a lie, so it's very difficult to get to the bottom of these things.
And also, of course, there are deliberate deceptions out there designed to entrap people like you and I, you know. They'll say, well, how about this for a story?
Yeah.
And the idea is that you pick it up. It's the straw man theory. You pick up a story, you start waving it around everywhere, and then everyone says, look, you idiot, that's a lie.
Yeah.
Because it's been deliberately thrown in your direction. But anyway, I think
we have that going on at the moment with the flat earthers. I don't know if you've seen much of that going on.
Well, and also
there's a lot of people jumping on the Hampstead scandal as well, which is quite potentially
completely deliberately put there to sucker in good campaigners and ruin their reputations. Anyway, so if you had to go to a website in 2 or 3 minutes just to pick up on a bit of basic news, it wouldn't be the BBC, would it?
I wouldn't. Oh no.
Where would you go?
I checked the BBC to see what disinfo. It's funny. I was. I met a BBC producer earlier on today. While I was having a cigarette outside the pub, I had a meeting with somebody, and we were chatting about LinkedIn, and she mentioned that she was unemployed, but LinkedIn is quite good. So I asked her what she did, and she said, "Oh, I used to work for the BBC." I said, "Oh, that's fascinating. What happened there?" She said, "Well, I couldn't really." She said, "I don't really want to go into it." And I said, "Well, I'm not a big fan of the BBC. My big problem with the BBC is the news. The news that they put out is diabolical, really." And she that's the reason that she ended up walking out of her position there, was over the news. She was a radio production. Unfortunately, I didn't get to have a further conversation with her. She was with another chap, and I didn't want to interrupt them. And the next time I looked around, they sort of disappeared off. But that, you know, it's just another... It's, even the people at the BBC seem to be discontent.
Well, what's happening is they're slowly weeding out decent people and putting kind of stooges in. You end up with a whole bunch of... either cowards or control freaks, and if you've got any guts, you're not going to last that long. So it's a real pity that that's what's happened with it. But
isn't it quite true? So I remember you saying, because you used to do a little bit of filming down at the BBC, sort of as a freelance. And one story I always thought was quite fascinating. I used to go down there, and even the BBC had RT on in the background, trying to find out what's going on in the world.
Well, that's right. I mean, actually, when we worked on Greater London Radio in London, we would constantly have LBC going on, so that in every bulletin, everyone would be quiet. Whilst our newsreader was in reading the bulletin, we would be listening intently to the LBC bulletin to see if there's anything we've missed, which is a good way. It was friendly competition. It wasn't, you know, I think that what bothers me about the modern world is there's this really ruthless cutthroat competition. Friendly competition, I think, there's nothing wrong with it. But as soon as you decide you're going to try and undermine your competition and take them out, basically, then it's almost like a war zone. Anyway, Rick Margetts, thanks very much for joining us on Dialect today.
Thanks a lot. Bye.
That's all for this week. Dialect is Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast and used to be broadcast on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday. If you're online, you can subscribe to our emails or download the podcast from dialectradio.co.uk. So thanks to our guests this week, Sam Downey, Maurice Kirk and Rick Margetts. He's from the International Community Radio Network, as was, and also, of course, to studio engineer Dave Bazanko. Dialect's a Bristol Broadband Co-op production, and anyone can contribute. Just contact us through Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733 or at bristolvolunteers.org.uk. That was Dialect. And I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. Till the same time next week. Goodbye for now.